Order the meeting of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will try to announce that when that does happen. We're not anticipating taking any votes today, but we do have a lot that we want to try to get through this week. And yesterday we did have apparently too aggressive of a schedule, and we didn't quite get finished with what we had thought we were going to cover yesterday. So we continued that discussion over to this morning, and so I would certainly like to invite members from the department. I believe we were talking about some of the some grants in the and maybe Ms. Sullivan Sutton can help us recall exactly where we were, and we can take it up. Welcome to the committee this morning. Appreciate your coming back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm with the Department of Human Services. We are on page 28 of the change pages.
All right.
The governor's recommendation here, I'll make sure you can hear me.
Yes, make sure you have that microphone, even though Senator Higgins is not here yet, but she certainly will remind us.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be ready when she is.
All right.
The governor recommends ending the state community action grants effective July 1 of 2011. This would result in a general fund savings of $7.8 million for the biennium. Loss of the community action grants will have varying results across the state. And the page notes that the loss of state funds does not jeopardize these agencies' federal funding. However, I should note so that you're aware that when the president released his budget on the 14th of February, his recommendation is that there be a 50% reduction in the federal funds supporting this activity as well. The Minnesota Community Action Grants provide funding to a statewide network of 28 nonprofit or public community action agencies and to 11 tribal governments, which offer safety net supports and services that promote economic self-sufficiency to low-income families and individuals in the communities.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, could you help us, at least, or help me anyway? That's great language. I'm not sure if I'm clear exactly what that money is used for. Can you describe in greater detail what we're doing with the grants and what is the activity that is being funded?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. These are funds that are provided to community action agencies, as I mentioned, that help them pay for the infrastructure, for the services that they provide to people in their communities. The community action agencies actually are responsible for administering a wide variety of programs to low-income individuals in the community that are paid for from a variety of sources, both currently state, federal, as well as private dollars. The types of services that the agencies provide include asset development, emergency shelter, helping people access the emergency shelter, transitional housing, energy assistance, financial fitness and financial literacy. They administer our food shelves in Minnesota, and they provide food support, outreach, and nutrition programs. They also help low-income individuals with tax preparation. Some also administer Head Start and child care. So you can see there's a continuum of services that they provide. The $3.9 million is the resources that they currently provide along the whole continuum of services is about $460 million with combined resources, as I indicated. This would eliminate the state appropriation that helps them with their administration. They also do use these state funds on some occasions as a match for either federal or private dollars as well.
So, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, the amount of money that these community action agencies administers is about 400 and some million?
Yes, through all programs combined that they administer.
And Ms. Sullivan Sutton, the community action agencies, how long have those structures been in existence in Minnesota?
60s.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to look to the back. I believe the 1960s. They've been around for a while. And I should also mention, Mr. Chairman, that the reductions here do not speak to the value of these programs in the community. These are very important programs to the community, but we believe and hope that because they do draw upon a variety of resources available, that they will be able to continue to operate, although this is a reduction in their support.
Well, Ms. Holmes, Sullivan Sutton, that was my question. If you've got a group of agencies, local agencies, that are spending $490 million, and we're talking about removing less than $4 million, and that's the entirety of this particular grant, it seems like that's a relatively small portion of the total money that they're using to provide whatever services they're providing. Were these grants, why would we create a program that says we're going to add an additional $4 million on top of $400 million? Is there a particular purpose that these grants were supposed to fulfill that the other funding was not fulfilling? Or I'm just not clear why we have this relatively small grant structure on top of a very, very large dollar amount, unless there's a particular thing that it was supposed to do.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Connie Greer to come to the table. Connie is responsible for managing the community action work that we do.
Mr. Chair, Connie Greer, Department of Human Services. The state funding for community action agencies was started in 1976, and these state funds are used to leverage dollars, this range of $400 million. Sometimes it's used as a match at the local level, sometimes used to leverage foundation and other resources.
And I apologize, I didn't quite catch your last name, please.
Mr. Chair, Connie Greer.
Greer, sorry, Ms. Greer. So the $4 million is allowing these local agencies to access the $400 million, or some portion of it, or
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Is it the bulk of it? If these $4 million leave, does that mean they were not able to get any of the federal money or any of the other money involved, or what exactly is the relationship?
Mr. Chair, each local agency uses the funds based on their local decision-making process. There's a three-part board, so part of this money, part of the state's $4 million leverages. Part of it is used as a match, and it varies from agency to agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, might I just ask why the decision was made to eliminate this grant program rather than to reduce all the other grant programs slightly more?
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, the decision was in part due to the richness of the resources available and administered through this program, and a decision was made not to reduce all of the grants on an across-the-board basis.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. I'm asking why.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I can give you one example. It was in the area, one of the issues that we looked at was reductions in some of the grant programs that provide for services to help kids get adopted, not the adoption assistance I mentioned yesterday, but some of the other work to promote permanency. And at the time, the senior management did not want to make those reductions that would prevent kids from going into out-of-home care. Again, here, and there were some other decisions along the way. There was also a desire to maintain benefits and not reduce benefits or reduce eligibility in other areas. So it really was looked at. We have to take reductions. Can we minimize the damage, so to speak, and that's in part because these programs do administer such rich variety of resources. The decision was made to balance that.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, when you mentioned earlier some of the money is used for federal matches and private sector matches, is the department's feeling that they can meet those matches in other ways, will it result in losing federal funds because we don't have matches, or?
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, we don't expect to meet those matches in other ways. As Ms. Greer indicated, each community action agency will decide what sort of resources to pursue or not pursue based on local needs. They may have other resources that, other private funds that could be used as match for federal funds or things like that, but they will need to look at what their options would be given the change in the budget environment in the future.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Moving on to page 21.
Thank you, Ms. Greer, by the way.
29, excuse me. The governor recommends eliminating the state funding for the Family Assets for Independence program in Minnesota, effective July 1. This is a small grants program administered by the community action agencies. Eliminating this program would result in a general fund savings of $492,000. This program does help low-income people save money to buy homes, start businesses, and further their education, as well as strengthen their financial literacy. Every state dollar does draw a federal dollar match, and both are used to match savings of program participants. So, for example, every dollar a participant saves will be matched by a federal dollar as well as a state dollar. This is part of a national network of individual development accounts, and people use the savings to be able to help them purchase houses, start small businesses, or pursue education. Again, this is a difficult reduction, but one that we felt was appropriate to make given the current budget environment.
Ms. Holden Sutton, can you give us a little bit of, I don't know what exactly the dollar amount that was in the budget for this activity in the current biennium. Was that money used entirely? Was it entirely used up in the course of the biennium to fund this activity, or were there monies left over, or was there more demand than resources? Can you just help us to understand that?
We use this money. There's probably more demand than the resources are available. I can also tell you that about 4,000 persons were served with this program. The average benefit to the individual is about $1,300.
And Ms. Sullivan, just so I understand, what we're doing here is we've got some state money that is drawing down or matching up with some federal money, and the idea would be that that's made available to people who would, I assume, qualify on the basis of income or something, that they, if they agree to save some money, then there's sort of a matching amount that is contributed. And is this done through counties then, or how is the administration done?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. This is an incentive to help low-income people save money. This program is administered through the community action agencies.
Community action.
And we would expect that they will continue some of the work that they're doing with respect to the financial literacy component, but the savings would be eliminated.
Thank you. Please continue.
The next several changes are on pages 30, 31, and 32. There are a number of recommendations to change the child care assistance program, to simplify the program, and to address both program integrity and improve the quality of child care in unregulated savings and settings, at the same time producing some savings to the program. There are a number of changes here. What I will try to do is walk through them one by one so you can see the totality of the pages, and then we'll be happy to take any questions. And we do have program experts in the room as well to help. The recommendation is to have a savings of about $6.7 million in the next biennium. The proposal makes changes to the Minnesota Family Investment Program, transition year child care, as well as to the basic sliding fee child care assistance program. There are a couple of changes that address program simplification, and in doing so, reduce cost of county administration of these programs. The first is to eliminate payments of child care providers for non-standard hours and payments for activity fees, effective September 2012. Under current law, 55 counties allow a non-standard hour differential, which is greater than the standard hourly maximum rate for payments to licensed child care providers who provide services outside of the normal hours. Also, activity fee payments are allowed under the CCAP for the provider, for various provider types. Both of these policies are pretty administratively burdensome for counties and not well understood by providers. Eliminating them would simplify the program and result in some savings. Families may be impacted by increased out-of-pocket cost, I should note, but we expect that to be minimal. We expect that this would result in approximately 65 monthly MFIP or transitional families to be impacted, and 90 families who are on the basic sliding fee program. I should also mention the basic sliding fee is available to families based on their income, but for individuals who are not a part of the MFIT program. The next item would limit the time an adult family member who is not in an authorized activity may be temporarily absent from the home to 60 days, effective April of 2012. Currently, a family member who's living away from the residence can be considered temporarily absent for an unlimited period of time. This would put a 60-day limit into that aspect.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, before you continue, can help me understand what is the effect of that? What is this policy trying to accomplish? I understand that what you're doing is you're saying that a family member can only live away from home for a certain period of time, and then something happens. As right now, there's no limit on them.
Yes.
What's going on here with this?
It has to do with if the absent family member has no income, whether or not the individual is counted in the family size, which could result in a change in the co-payment, or it could result in a change in eligibility. The absent family member continues to be counted in the family size right now indefinitely, and their income may be included, but if we limit the time limit, they're not a part of the family size for those purposes.
So, Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, these are adult members of the family. These are not children, I assume.
These are adult members of the family.
So right now we say if you've got a family that has some adults as a part of the family, that can be included as counting the number of people in the family for purposes of receiving some benefit plan.
That's correct.
And right now if some of those adults leave the family for some period of time, there's no problem with that. They could be gone indefinitely and still would qualify under this current structure for the higher level of reimbursement. All you're saying here is that you want to limit that absence to, 60 days? And after that, then there would be a change in the structure that
yes,
would result in some lower reimbursement, I suppose?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Could you tell me what is the total amount of the child care assistance program in the current biennium, the total amount, and what would be the total amount left in the adult family area under paragraph number 2 after your cut? How much money are we talking about?
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, currently between the two child care programs, there's $216 million in expenditures. The basic sliding fee, what is projected without any changes, would be $96 million. And in MFIP and transition year, there is a projection of $120 million. We could also provide you a very detailed breakdown for each of the items on what will be MFIP transition year savings as well as basic sliding fee savings. In total, so we can make that available to the committee.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, I guess also to that point, could you also provide information what the effect of point number 2 would have, at least in your projections or anticipation of savings by putting in place a 60-day limit on absent family members?
Yes. If interested, we can provide the committee a detailed breakdown
Thank
on
you.
Each of these items.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to number 1 and just ask a question about that policy change. I'm assuming that the reason that we have allowed a larger payment for non-standard hours is because overnight care is more expensive than daytime care. Is that correct?
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's my understanding.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, would this then mean that it would be harder for someone trying to transition off of MFIP to take a job during non-standard hours because their child care would cost them more?
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it is hard to tell the impact. Currently, this is only provided in 55 counties, so it's not available in all 87 counties. It may It may impact some individuals, but it's difficult to predict exactly how many and what their options will be as a result. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, if you couldn't estimate how many individuals will be impacted, how did you figure out how much the savings would be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, on that particular item, the dollar value that we have for you is the elimination of the activity fees, and we have an estimate based on caseload size, but there is, we don't have an estimate based on exact expenditures, but we do have an estimate based on how many individuals we think will be impacted by this change, which is noted in that paragraph.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sullivan Sutton, so you don't know how many people are affected by the change in the non-standard hour payment, and the savings is based only on the amount that is provided for the activity fees? Is that what you just said to me?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, yes, the dollar estimate here is based on the activity fee. We can tell you how many families we expect to be impacted by the non-standard hour. What we don't have is the exact dollar value by family.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund.
Then how many individuals would be affected by the non-standard hour change?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, our staff estimate that approximately 65 average monthly families would be affected by this change.
So, Mr. Chairman, then I'm back to my question of, for those 65 families, is it going to be harder for them to keep their non-standard hours or their non-standard hour job because the child care is going to cost them more?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Sheree Kotelnik, who's the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program, to try to help respond to Senator Berglund's question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we came forward with this change primarily based on the results of research that we had done nationally on market rate surveys. In 1996, the non-standard hour rates were established in an attempt to create more non-standard hour care providers. When we did research in 2009 in a study called the Alternative Methods for Minnesota's Market Rate Study of Child Care Prices, the University of Minnesota and the University of Oregon helped us to determine that actually paying higher rates for non-standard hour care did not create more care or create more access for care. And when we did our market rate survey, in some cases, the non-standard hour care, because it was overnight and evenings, was a lower cost, and we weren't paying less for non-standard hour care when the market charged less, but we were paying more when the market indicated more. And it became a policy that wasn't achieving the original intended goals and was very complicated to administer. And in an attempt to simplify the program, we're reducing this.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan, before we leave that point, can you, 55 counties, are Hennepin and Ramsey County included in the 55 counties that have this structure?
Hennepin is, and Ramsey is.
Thank you. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For purposes of this program, what is the definition of an adult family member?
A parent.
Ms. Tilnick.
Mr. Chair, sorry. It's a parent, a legal guardian, or a biological or a legal parent or a legal guardian.
Well, Mr. Chair, just clarifying, so then adult children over what age, is age 18 or age 21, at what point would they not be counted as an adult family?
Adult children are only counted when they're over 18 if the family can show that they pay for most of the expenses of the child.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
And you're defining parent as either biological or legal guardian. So if we had a couple that was cohabiting, that individual would not be counted as an adult family member, or would?
Ms. Tilling?
That person would not be counted as adult family member if they weren't a parent to a child in the unit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. So an example of an adult family member might be somebody who's scheduled to be in Iraq for a period of time, or a person who might be hospitalized for a psychiatric crisis for a period of time. Is that what we're talking about here?
Ms. Tillink.
It's possible that the person who is hospitalized for psychiatric crisis and is not earning any income during that time would be included in this exemption, the 60-day limit. Someone working in Iraq as part of the military would be getting income that would be counted as family income, and they would be included in the family size.
And so just so I understand, what we're saying is that the exclusion of someone away from the family would only be in the case that that person was not contributing income to the family. Is that correct?
Correct.
Right. Thank you. Please continue. And, Ms. Tillich, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Could you spell it for me, please?
It's K-O-T-I-L-I-N-E-K.
K-O-T-I-L.
I-N-E-K.
Katilnik. Sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm moving to item 3 on page 31. This proposal would eliminate absent day payments for legal, non-licensed family child care providers and limit absent day payments to 10 days per calendar year for licensed providers and licensed exempt centers with no exceptions effective January 2013. Current policy allows for providers to be reimbursed for up to 10 days for a total of 25 days per calendar year, in addition to holidays if their policy is to charge families for those absences. In certain situations, exemptions may be granted when a medical condition has been documented. This proposal would eliminate payments for absent days to non-licensed family providers and would limit absent day payments for licensed providers. It could have an impact on families who may be asked to pay for absent days by their provider, but that payment would no longer be authorized or reimbursed by the child care assistance program. This proposal could impact families receiving child care assistance, as it does provide some limitations on the use of the public funds.
Could you, just for those of us who are acronym impaired, the LNL?
Legally non-licensed care is situations where a family may be providing care to the children of one other family. The law does not require that they be licensed in those situations.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, what does a family have to go through to document a medical condition?
Ms. Katilnik?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, they need to fill out a form and have some medical person sign it and submit it to the county, and the county keeps it on record.
So, Senator Berglund? Mr. Chairman, if a child has the flu and they're out for a week and then they develop a cold and they're out for a week and then they develop another illness, somehow they'd have to document that all of these illnesses occurred at that point in time that they're reaching the number 10-day.
Ms. Katilnik.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, under current law, if it doesn't exceed 10 days, they would not have to do that. But under the proposal, they would not have to do any kind of documentation. They would have 10 days just because.
Right, but if it's more than 10 days, Mr. Chairman, it's more than 10 days, they don't get the payment at all, or they have to document, or what is the proposal doing exactly?
Ms. Katilnik.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, this proposal would limit payment to 10 days.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I have a concern about this because, you know, if you have a child with asthma or you have a child that has some other medical problem that might not be a good idea for them to be in a daycare center, then if it's going to be more than 10 days, you're going to feel like you've got to send them because you're going to you're going to get charged otherwise by the provider and not have a way to pay for it.
Ms. Sullivan said.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that could occur.
Senator Higgins, did you have a question earlier?
Mr. Chair, only that a request to the testifiers bring their microphones up to their mouth. I am so sorry.
We reminded them before you got here, but people push. You know, they talk and things get pushed back. I understand, but thank you. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Please
Mr.
continue,
Chairman, members.
Ms. Sullivan, please bring it right up next to you.
Is that better, Senator Higgins?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to the next item. This would prohibit payments that exceed the daily or weekly maximum rates for centers and licensed family providers and limit payments to those legal non-licensed providers to no more than 50 hours per week at the maximum hourly rate or 10 hours per day effective April 2012. Under current law, providers can be paid for child care based on the maximum weekly rate plus a maximum hourly rate for hours over 50 per week, or care based on the maximum daily rate plus the maximum rate for hours per day. Basically, what we are doing here is capping the amount of payment available to no more than the 50 hours per week or $10 per day.
Thank you.
The next several items have to deal with program integrity, and the proposals here try to strengthen program integrity by restricting payments of the child care assistance program in situations that may result in improper payments being made in the program. The first area would prohibit child care assistance payments for child care provided by someone who resides in the same residence as the children, effective March of 2012. Many other states apply the same restriction for child care. The impact of the proposal would be on payments to legal, non-licensed, and licensed family providers who care for children with whom they reside. We estimate that this would impact approximately 100 average monthly cases under the MFIP transition year and 70 basic sliding fee cases. We do anticipate that this may result in some providers stopping their business, and it may result in some families changing the providers. The next item would restrict child care assistance payments for child care provided in the children's own home, effective in March of 2012. Federal regulations require that states must allow some in-home care, but states are allowed to establish limits on the use. Under current policy, payment for care provided in the child's own home is not restricted. This proposal would restrict payment for care in the child's own home and would allow it only if the parent's qualifying activity occurs during times when out-of-home care is not available, the family lives in an area where out-of-home care is not accessible or available, or that the child has a verified illness or disability that would create a hardship or for the child. We estimate that this change would impact approximately 500 families on the MFIP program and about 400 on the basic sliding fee. The next item is actually does not have a fiscal cost, but it's also an item with respect to program integrity that would limit child care payments to centers that provide child care services so that someone who is employed by a child care center and their child was in the center, they would not also be getting child care assistance during that time. The next area has to do with quality supports, and this deals with trying to increase the quality of care provided to high-risk children who are cared for in legally non-licensed child care. This proposal would increase registration requirements for those providers as well as training requirements. Currently, family, friends, and neighbors providers have to pass criminal background check, and counties have to inform providers about health and safety resources. This proposal would add a requirement that providers complete a first aid and CPR training prior to receiving the public child care funds. And in addition to that, upon renewal of their two-year registration period, the provider would have to verify that they have attended at least 8 hours of additional training, which is listed in the Child Care Professional Development Registry, and it includes training things such as health, safety, nutrition, and basic child development information. This training requirement would apply to providers effective 11-1 of 2011 and would be phased in to the existing providers as they renew their registrations in 2012 and beyond. We would notify providers of the new requirements, and essentially what this would do is equate to about 8 hours of training every 2 years. And the impact will be that some providers may choose not to continue providing care and will not attend the training, and close others may be willing to attend the training. Again, this is an effort to try to continue to improve the quality of care provided to high-risk children who are on our public programs.
Thank you.
The other thing I want to point out on that page is actually in the fiscal detail for budget tracking. You will see that there is an expenditure under finance and management of $168,000 that involves program changes that are needed for our information system to implement all of the changes on the pages preceding.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item is on page 33. This has to do with the basic sliding fee child care assistance program. What we are proposing here is to reduce spending in the child care assistance program by reducing the funding available because of underspending. Essentially, what has happened is approximately each year for the past 5 years, there has been about $6 million underspending in the basic sliding fee program. We anticipate that there will be a similar amount this year and are proposing a one-time transfer of the underspending to the general fund.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
I apologize. Going back to the previous page 30-32, can you tell me what the eligibility criteria are for that program, for the child care assistance program?
Ms. Kotelnik?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nino, the child care assistance program has two sets of eligibility criteria, the MFIP and transition year child care. You have to be on the MFIP or DWP programs in Minnesota and need child care assistance, so be participating in an authorized activity. In order to get into transition year, you have to have been on MFIP or DWP for 3 out of the last 6 months, and then you're part of the forecasted program that supports child care costs for up to a year after leaving the MFIP or DWP program. Basic sliding fee has an entry level of 47% of the state median income and an exit level of 67% of the state median income. And that's generally for families who are either coming off of the transition year program or for families who are applying from outside of the assistance programs. And they have to be participating in authorized activities also. That for basic sliding fee, that's job search, education, or employment.
Senator Nino.
And for our purposes, do you know that 47% to 67%, what that translates into in real dollars, and is that indexed for family size, or is that just for household income overall?
Ms. Kotelnik.
Mr. Chair and Senator, do you know? It is indexed for family size, and for a three-person family, 47% of the state median income is $34,348, and 67% is $48,965.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. The next item is on page 34, and this has to do with a recommendation to increase the child support recovery fee from 1% to 2%, and this would result in a general fund savings of approximately $1.6 million in the biennium. Federal regulations permit us to charge a fee For child support for the non-public assistance cases under current law, Minnesota, we have a 1% fee. We generate about $3.2 million in that fee. 66% of that goes to the back to the federal government, and the remainder, which is about 1.08%, is retained and distributed to the counties. What this proposal essentially does is recommends that the fee increase be increased to 2%. 66% of the 2% would go to back to the federal government. 1.08 would continue to go to the counties, and then the additional, it's about $1.1 million a year, would be used to refinance the child support information system. So that fee would go to the child support information system, and then we would the general fund appropriations that are currently supporting that information system would be redirected back to the general fund.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, what is the reason that this money collected goes to the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, members, this has to do with the federal participation rights. The federal government, when we have activities that can be matched by the federal government, they pay us 66%. And in a like manner, when we're having these collections, they are entitled to receive 66% back.
I see. Thank you.
The next item is on page 35, and this has to do with the Social Supplemental Security Income Interim Assistance Reimbursement Program, and what we are recommending is that the carry-forward balance in that account be redirected to the general fund, that the money be canceled, and the balance be redirected to the general fund. Under current law, for individuals who are applying for general assistance, they are required to apply for supplemental security income. And for in that process, they sign an agreement with the state that says if they are eligible for supplemental security income, that funds that were paid to them during that application period go back to the general fund, except that 35% of the recovery or the funds received are redirected into this account, so the state has resources available to promote advocacy and outreach for individuals to help people who are eligible for SSI to apply for and receive those benefits. As I mentioned, this is carry forward. There would continue to be an estimated $3.5 million available to pay for this advocacy and outreach work.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, this isn't really a question related to this budget page, but, you know, a couple years ago we increased staffing at the department to help counties be able to process the SSI applications more quickly, and I'm wondering whether we have actually reduced the length of time on average that it's taking people in Minnesota who otherwise would be eligible for general assistance to get through the SSI process.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we can get you more specific information on the length of time to process those applications. What I can tell you is that since the state took over processing in 2006, that we have seen more recoveries than we had before that. But we can get you more detailed information on the length of time.
I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Please continue.
The next item is on page 36. And the governor is recommending using existing state spending in the child care assistance program to leverage additional federal food stamp employment and training funds. This change allows the general fund to realize a savings of $1 million in the 2012-13 biennium. We can receive federal reimbursement for expenditures under the food support program for supporting and serving for support services to help people find and retain employment. That includes child care expenses, and that is one of the supports so that by allowing us to use expenditures in the child care assistance program, we're able to receive the federal match, which would realize in the $1 million that are shown on this page.
Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry. I'm still back on page 34, and I'm sorry to take everybody back there. But and you don't have to answer this now, but in light of an earlier conversation we had, maybe that was yesterday, time goes by so quickly, about child support recovery costs, in which we were asking several of us on the committee about the ability to charge the uncustodial parent for some of the administrative costs to make up the losses at the county level, or the state could collect, instead of passing it to the county, could collect and make that $3.5 million up in a cost recovery fee to the non-custodial parent. This seems to me to be a similar concept. These are persons who are not on public programs from whom child support is being collected, if I understand it correctly, and you're allowed to assess a fee to pay for those administrative costs. Am I understanding that correctly here? And I wonder if that is correct, why we can't apply that concept in the other program that we were discussing.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, you could increase the fees here. There is a maximum that's included on the page, I believe in the fourth paragraph. The maximum per case is $674 per year, but you could have some increases. I think the other balance is at what level of increase might deter someone from going through our child support collection process. But if you are interested, I would be happy to have some of our child support staff follow up directly with you to provide more detailed technical assistance on that issue.
Thank you. And I think that the deterrent would be that it's being taken out of the money that you pay to the, once the money's collected, it's taken out of the collection. Let's say it's $120 a month that you collect. You take your fee out of that $120 instead of adding that fee on to the $120 for the person who is delinquent in making the payment pay the fee rather than the family member asking for the child support payment. That's where we're trying to get the emphasis placed, over on the delinquent payer.
Ms. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe that's correct. The other thing is that the fee cannot be greater than the amount of the cost to administer the program, so that the money that's intended to go to the child does go to the care of the child.
Yes,
one thing I do want to point out on that page, and thank you for bringing me back there, I had intended to point out on page 34, the very last sentence, there is a cost for programming required to implement the change on the child support page. That should read $90,000, not $9,000, and the state share of that is approximately $31,000, which is reflected in the page.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, I think another important fact is that under current law, the user fee is paid by the applicant for child support services. And usually the applicant is the obligee, not the obligor. And so in that case, the fee is being subtracted from the amount of child support being collected. So it does have a disincentive for people to apply to get the child support collected if a lot of it's being taken out in a user fee.
Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, on that point, I guess, can you clarify, is this a service that is optional for people, or is it a mandatory recovery cost? In other words, if people are separated, divorced, and there is a child support obligation, can they choose not to have the state involved in collecting child support, or is this something that is just going to happen no matter what?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Waylon Campbell, the director of the Child Support Program, to respond to that question.
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Waylon Campbell. I'm the director of the Child Support Program. People can opt out of the Child Support Program if they wish, if both parties wish, both the custodial and non-custodial parent.
So, Mr. Campbell, if you have people who are separated and let's say the ex-husband has an obligation to provide support and is willing to do it and is, in fact, doing it voluntarily, but the spouse desires to have this service implemented at a cost, then it is done even though the person making the child support payments is currently doing it without having a collection fee? Is that what happens?
Mr. Chair, it's optional to be in the program, but once you're in the program, the fee is not optional. The fee is charged, as was mentioned before by Senator Berglund, to the individual that applies for services.
So what you're describing is that only one of the people has to ask for this service, and then the fee is implemented, and it doesn't – I guess what I'm getting at, and the reason I'm asking is I know in past years I've had people talk to me about this and are concerned about the costs and the fees that are being collected in circumstances where they would say there is no need to have a collection at all, that people are voluntarily and willingly paying the support, but there still is a fee being collected because one of the people in the relationship or former relationship has requested the assistance of the state. Is that something that should be, or can it be changed, or what's your take on that?
Mr. Chair, I think the policy works fairly straightforwardly and well, myself.
Right. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I think probably we need a little bit of clarification. I don't believe that being in the recovery program is optional if you're in the MFIP program.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's correct.
Right, because that's taxpayer dollars that are being recovered. So, and if there are arrearages from when you were in the MFIP program, I don't believe it's optional then either.
Mr.
Is that
Campbell.
Correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if there are arrears, after one goes off public assistance, one does not need to remain in the program, but we will still try to collect that money that was owed to the state.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman, how do we try to collect it?
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, using all the enforcement mechanisms that we have that we can use for collect arrearages.
Mr. Chairman, then who is the fee charged to in those cases?
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, if we don't have somebody receiving, if there is no fee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
So if you're trying to collect an arrearage from when someone is in the MFIP program and child support was not being paid, there is no fee charged for trying to enforce that payment?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, there is no fee charged for public assistance cases, and if there was no collection made during the time when arrearages, when the person was on public assistance and arrears accrued, and the person is not on public assistance, we would not charge a party to collect money for ourselves.
Well, Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Berglund.
I guess just an observation. I think this idea that that the person who pays the fee is the person that's requesting the collection is maybe a little erroneous. People have an obligation to pay child support, and if they're not paying it, they know they're not paying it, and perhaps then they should be the ones that are paying the fee to try to collect it and not the person that needs to have the support in order to feed their children. And if someone is avoiding paying and the taxpayers are at risk, then I certainly think the person that has not been making the payment should be paying the fee and not the taxpayer.
Senator Newman, did you have a question?
Mr. Campbell, could you explain, just to help me out, why we do not collect fees for folks who are receiving or on public assistance? Is there no obligor out there that is obligated to pay child support?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, if in the case of a public assistance situation, I think there really is no direct applicant for services in the sense that a person doesn't voluntarily come in and apply. They do get child support services because we're required to provide them by law. But if we're to charge a fee, then, for very low assistance, for people on public assistance, first of all, if we're providing public assistance, it doesn't make sense to charge someone a fee when they're already getting public money to get by. frequently that situation is the same for the non-custodial parent in that income group.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Campbell, if someone is receiving public assistance and the non-custodial parent is under an obligation to provide child support payments, does Health and Human Services attempt to collect that money back from the non-custodial parent, and do we charge a fee for that?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, we do try to collect all the support that is due. We do not charge a fee under those circumstances.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Why not?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, we don't, it's the law that was set up that way, that we don't charge fees in public assistance cases. In fact, we don't charge fees in non-public assistance cases until public assistance has terminated for at least 2 years.
Mr. Campbell, is that by statute? Is it by rule? Is it by a commissioner's order? How do we arrive at this situation?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, it's in statute, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Do we also not charge them any interest on what they owe us?
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, we do charge interest.
Okay.
Senator Hahn.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I think everybody sort of gets the problem here, that we should look at who we're charging the administrative fees, and if it were just further penalizing the person that has the right to the payment. In the cases where, whether it's a public program or in this case not, certainly there are people from whom we are collecting child support payments who are unemployed, may not have income, maybe on public programs themselves, but there are many who can pay. And I think in the past, Senator Berglund certainly has questioned this policy, and that it's one that we ought to be taking a look at, particularly if we can raise revenue for the general fund for this group of people that we're talking about here, and in the public programs, if we can save the counties from having to dip onto property taxes for trying to recover some of these costs, I think it's worth our examination. And I think everybody's sort of coming to see that unless there's some rule or law that prohibits us from tacking this not onto the person who is getting the child support, but on the person that is maybe for no good reason at all, just being resistive, is not paying their obligations to the family. So I hope we examine this, if it's a policy we can change.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. I think you're raising a good point, and I think to the extent that we're able and have time to do that, and if members have some interest in trying to suggest some policy changes, let's take a look at that. I think it's a good point. Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, thank you, Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, members, one last page, page 37. And this involves a recommendation to direct TANF funds to the MFIP child care program in an amount of $14,020,000, which I'll give you the breakdown of that in a moment. Federal law allows states to use up to 30% of their TANF block grants to carry out a state program under the Child Care Development Block Grant, or Title 20 of the Social Security Act. And what this recommendation does is recommends directing TANF funds, as I mentioned, to the MFIP child care program of $14 million. There's also a recommendation at the very bottom of the page that would involve refinancing a $20,000 of reduction in the TANF funds currently going to the Department of Health that results in funding for TANF evaluation and training for American Indian tribes and local communities, and you'll see a corresponding page in the Department of Health's budget book. But essentially what this does is recommend using TANF funds in the child care program, and then $14 million of general fund appropriations from child care would be redirected back to the general fund. And this goes along with the first page that we had in the document regarding the $14 million of the MFIP consolidated fund.
Thank you. Senator Birdland.
Mr. Chairman, my question isn't about this page, but since this is the last page of this section, I wanted to just ask Ms. Sullivan Sutton if the question that I asked yesterday about the proposal to increase licensing fees and fees for background checks, how many and to what monetary extent it would affect people who are licensed and are being cut in other proposals in the governor's budget. Do we have that information yet?
Ms. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I believe Jerry Kerber was going to back to look at that information, so we will follow up with you. I don't know that Jerry is in the room.
I will wait.
Senator Berglund, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, for your willingness to come back. And you are kind of amazing that you know this in such detail. We appreciate it because most of us do not. And I appreciate your tolerance for our questions. There are likely to be some additional ones. And I know we've made some requests for information and some detail. Look forward to having that provided. And members, any other questions for Ms. Sullivan Sutton at this point? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
And I think the next section that we wanted to review was the chemical and mental health changes. And please, thank you. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services. And I think my section starts on page 94, and the first proposal is to, or maybe wait until everybody's there. This first proposal is to tighten the chemical dependency placement criteria for placement into residential programs. The current placement criteria allows some clients to receive residential treatment when they would be able to benefit from a non-residential treatment combined with a board and lodging referral. So this proposal essentially would limit residential placements to only those persons scoring highest on the severity scores of relapse and recovery. This proposal generates general fund savings of $9.086 million for the 2012-13 biennium. However, as a result of this proposal, 1,895 placements that would have been made to a residential setting will now be made to outpatient chemical dependency treatment.
Ms. O'Connell, this is a, as you said, $9 million, slightly over $9 million reduction for the 12-13 biennium. What is the current total dollar amount that is in this year's, but this biennium's budget for this these services? What is the total dollar amount we're taking $9 million from?
I think that unlike Assistant Commissioner Sullivan, after 2 weeks on the job, I'm not quite prepared to answer that, but I will see if some of my teammates are. And I think Bill Weiss, the division director for chemical dependency, is going to attempt to answer that question.
Mr. Weiss, welcome to the committee. Please.
Mr. Chair, again, my name is Bill Weiss. I'm the acting director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. And, Mr. Chair, could you please repeat your question?
Well, Mr. Weiss, I was just curious to know, we're discussing a $9 million reduction to the budget. Just wanted to get an idea of what the current size of this area of the budget that we're subtracting $9 million from.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, the state obligation for fiscal year 11 is $102,659,514. That's the state's obligation for this particular fund.
So, Mr. Weiss, that's the current biennium, $102.6 million. Is that correct?
That's correct,
and
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Weiss, the reduction, is that a reduction from the current level of spending?
Mr. Chair, this is for fiscal year 2011, the number I gave you.
Just for 1 year, fiscal year 11. So over the biennium, maybe double that roughly?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And that's the current biennium level of spending. And this reduction that you're proposing, is that a reduction from the current level of spending, or is it a reduction from the November forecasted amounts for this budget area?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is from the current budget that I just provided you. The current number.
And so, Mr. Weiss, what you're saying is that fiscal year 11 has $102 million, and this is a reduction, so it would be slightly less than $100 million going forward. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Senator Berglund.
Chairman, Assistant Commissioner, who would pay for the board and lodging costs while a person is in outpatient treatment under this proposal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, if for the non-MA recipients, that would be the county responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Weiss. For the MA clients or the Minnesota Care clients, who would be paying the board and lodging costs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brogan, that would be the fund, the Chemical-Dependency Treatment Fund.
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
That would be the Chemical-Dependency Treatment Fund. Let me bring this closer.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund,
and Mr. Weiss, are the board and lodging costs that the state would continue to pay then less than they would be if they were in a residential setting?
Mr. Chair.
When I ask that question, please include in that question the factor of federal funding.
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, yes, I don't have the exact numbers of the cost differential, but that outpatient and board and lodging would be less expensive than a residential treatment program.
Senator Berger?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Weiss, will medical assistance pay for board and lodging costs?
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the fund for folks that are eligible for medical assistance, those are the blended fund, and yes, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss, just going back to, I just want to clarify the question that I am trying to ask. Maybe I'm not asking it accurately, but my understanding is we have a current level of spending in the current biennium. We have a forecast that came out in November projecting some higher levels of spending. My question is that the reduction that you're proposing, is it to that forecasted amount that came out in November, or is it to the current level of spending in the current fiscal biennium?
Mr. Chair, the question is that it is the forecast amount.
So, Mr. Weiss, just to be clear, this is a $9 million reduction from the forecast. Can you tell us what the difference between the forecast amount and the current biennial spending is for this area of the budget?
The amount I have is the forecast. I don't have the actual amount at me right now.
And, Mr. Weiss, what do you have as the forecasted amount?
That's correct.
And what could you tell us what that number is, the total forecasted amount?
The number I gave you previously, the $102 million.
So, Mr. Weiss, the $102 million is the forecasted amount.
It doesn't tell us for the state obligation.
But not necessarily what the current spending level is in the current biennium.
Mr. Chad's correct.
That might be useful to know. Mr. Albrecht, can you help us out?
Mr. Chair and members, if you go way to the back of your book, there's a budget page for the CD entitlement grants. It's page number 84. Actually, it's one of the 84s. the general fund appropriation for CD entitlement grants in this biennium is $87.5 million in fiscal year 10 and $93.8 million in fiscal year 11. The general fund forecast for the next biennium continues the amount for 2011, so about $94 million a year for a total of $188 million in the next biennium.
So, Mr. Albrecht, what that tells me for looking on page 84 of the forecasted that the 10-11 biennium we were showing 87.5 million in 10, 93.8 in 11, and then for the forecast carrying forward to 93.8. So the forecasted amount is slightly higher than the current biennium spending. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Yeah. And so the numbers that we're talking about here are reductions from the forecasted amount. Is that correct, Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Weiss or Ms. O'Connell, I see that you have, there's going to be the referral to go back into out of residential treatment is based upon the assessment areas of relapse recovery environment. Have those assessments changed recently? Have you done any work in that area of assessing?
Mr. Weiss?
Senator Hammond, Senator Rosen, my understanding is not. The changes took place in 2008, back in 2008.
Sorry.
And Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Weiss. What is the difference besides, of course, just residential as housing and non-residential? Is there any difference as far as treatment or length of period of treatment, and have you adjusted those criteria?
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the statute talks about 24-hour care in a residential facility. I think that would be the biggest difference. Certainly the level of care would need to be provided, but in the assessment criteria, the 24-hour care is the difference between the risk level 3 and the level 4 for dimension 5 and 6.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Weiss, and how about the length? Is there any difference between, is it still 28 day? Is it, what's the length of treatment that is provided?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I know we have in our Danes information the difference between outpatient and residential care, and we certainly can provide you with those numbers that we have available.
Senator Rosen.
Okay. I guess I need, Mr. Chair, I guess I need more information about the differences, and are we going to be able to serve this population with the numbers that were given, and perhaps adjust the treatment program to make sure that it's still effective and we're moving forward, and that's where I'm kind of going at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, so you're interested in the length of stay between residential and outpatient, looking at that difference.
Right. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Reese, and if your assessment is going to match these patients to the non-residential versus residential, and what's the difference, and are we just setting ourselves up for a problem down the road?
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you
have a question? Yes. Would you review again for me, because I didn't completely understand that once a person moves off the inpatient and into the board and lodging, whose responsibility increases in terms of covering those costs?
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, for the MA recipients, the room and board cost is built into the fund because the fund does cover folks under medical assistance. For folks that are not MA enrolled, that room board cost becomes a responsibility of the county.
Thank you. And do you have any sense at all of what we're passing on to the counties here that they have not planned for in the past?
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, are you asking the actual dollar amount or the impact on capacity?
Senator Sharon?
I'm talking about in terms of resolving the budget deficit in the general fund through this change, how are we impacting the county's obligations and budget requirements? Do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the increase is from 16.14 to 22.95, a 6.81 increase. I'm sorry. Certainly the responsibility on the county is their decision to make that decision in terms of placement. So it's the county's responsibility, and it's their impact.
Yep. I think it's significant. It's significant, and particularly in response to Senator Rosen's inquiry, the length of time that's needed for a high-risk population moved out of inpatient to the outpatient setting. But I also, just as a side comment, I noticed here that some of the criteria that you're looking at includes the client has no recognition or understanding of relapse and recidivism issues, and therefore, because of that, anybody without insight obviously is not going to change their behavior. But, you know, there's a point at which the lack of insight has been demonstrated a number of times, and so I would challenge that there be a limit established on that, that simply because somebody doesn't have insight and is likely to reuse is not, I think, in and of itself enough of a reason for the state to be underwriting the cost of an inpatient treatment setting.
Mr. Weiss.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, the criteria that you're describing is in the rule that dictates the assessment process. So we looked at the level four as the most severe, looking at trying to have more definitive precision about who goes in that level of care. But I understand your concern.
Yes, I understand the high-risk nature of lack of insight, but there is a point at which increased a re-entry into an inpatient setting is not going to change that factor.
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that could be correct, yes.
Senator Lurie?
Thank you, Chair Han. And I, going back to the board and lodging portion and who pays for it, I think one of the issues that I didn't quite get clear on, so for a Medicaid eligible individual receiving this outpatient with attached board and lodging, the consolidated fund would pay for it, but are there federal financial participation, FFP, ramifications to that? Will the feds share in that cost that the fund is used to support, or does the FFP lapse when you go into an outpatient setting, and then are they still a partner for the room and board component is, I think, one of the important factors that I never got clear on.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Anderson, our treatment supervisor, try to answer that question.
Right. Mr. Anderson, please introduce yourself.
My name is Gene Anderson. I'm the supervisor for the treatment services section of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. The savings that are targeted through this are folks that had a less than severe score in two criteria areas. And what happens is, because of the tightening of those restrictions, there's about 1,800 persons that currently in 2009 data would qualify for sure for outpatient treatment and could qualify for a room and board setting also, which could also be in residential. That's based on the 2008 change in statute or the rules. That became a similarity, if you will. So the savings in this is that the county is not having to place somebody in a room board setting if they're at this level three, only if they're at a level four, which is most highest severity of assessment. So that the client is still being placed and recommended for an outpatient setting. The federal share of this is, the federal share does not pay for the room and board at all. So that comes out of our state, county, and other collections.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman, that's the question I was trying to get at earlier, and I'd really like to see, when we lose the federal funding, how much we're actually saving on this room and board idea as opposed to the room and board costs for residential care.
Uh, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, in terms of losing the federal funding, we aren't losing federal funding on this proposal.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, then I don't understand your answer to Senator Lori. You said for the room and board component, we would not be getting any federal funding. When the room and board component is being paid for in a residential setting, it is paid for with federal funding.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund,
Mr. Anderson.
Currently the only persons that qualify for federal funding for the room and board would be those that are placed in a hospital setting. Room and board costs for a residential program or a room and board program are not covered at all by the federal block grant dollars or the MA match.
I want to get to Senator Newman and then Senator Higgins go up. But Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To any of the testifiers, it looks to me like we're spending between $90 and $100 million a year on this program. Can you give me any idea as to how many people are served by the program and some ideas to your success ratio?
Mr. Weiss? Or?
Yes. Chairman, the number of folks that had go through the consolidated, we had a placements of 28,176 for fiscal year 10, and the completion rates is 60%, according to the information we collect.
Senator Newman.
And can you give me an idea as to the recidivism?
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not have any recidivism numbers. I do have information that talks about of the 60% that did not completement treatment, what happened to those folks. I believe 20% left the program. There's a percentage that actually transferred to another program, but we do have those breakdown if you would like that information.
Mr. Weiss, I think we would like to see some of that, and I just want to be clear I understood. You're saying that of the 28,000 placements, 60% completed their program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct from the information we have.
And that 60% completion rate may not, to Senator Newman's question, speak to how many of them actually successfully have overcome the addiction problem, that there may be some portion of those that are recurring and going back into treatment at some subsequent time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, we do have information that talks about how many folks actually have gone into treatment based on episodes. And I believe the numbers are close to 99% for up to 1 to 2 placements within a year of time. So the recidivism rate in terms of how many placements is confined to 2 to 3 placements in that very high percentage.
Senator Chairman?
Mr. Weiss, we may need to see some data if you can provide
it. I actually have the document right in front of me here.
Well, maybe you could provide that to the committee. We'll get copies to people. I do want to. I know we've got a couple other questions, and I don't want to close off this discussion. So,
sure.
But Senator Higgins, I know you were trying to ask.
Mr. Chair, my question was, do we have 1,895 beds in board and lodging places around the state to accommodate these folks who are not going to go into the CD treatment in-house programs?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, the 1,895 number that's identified are folks that normally would be going to a board and lodge facility or residential facility and would no longer be attending a room and board placement. So they would be going from their living situation attending services that way.
Sorry, I twisted that all up in my brain.
Thank you. I think just given some of the questions that we're asking here, I think it would be helpful for us to be able to see the amount of money that we're spending in this area of the budget and just the result that we're getting for that. I think there's some questions in people's minds. I guess in my mind, I'll speak for myself. How effectively is this money being used? Are we really succeeding in the mission that I assume is to try to help people recover from addictions of various kinds. And if you've got some data that would at least clarify that, I'm guessing that there are some programs that do better than others. If you've got down to detail of what things seem to work, what things don't seem to work, when we're faced with dealing with trying to manage budget monies, I think we obviously want to try to focus on things that are working, and to the extent that we have information about that, that would be helpful. Senator Lori, do you have a question?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
The last question that I have is, what do you anticipate the recidivism rate would be under the new proposal where people would be not in a residential setting when they receive their treatment?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, that's obviously a concern. We don't have an estimation on the recidivism rate for that. It's really a population that's on the brink of needing a residential placement or a room and board placement, but isn't qualifying. Obviously, there would be, with the concerns regarding what they would have to meet for criteria, is still of concern enough that we would be estimating at least some of those folks would have recidivism issues.
Mr. Chairman, just one last question. So why don't we just pay the providers who are providing the treatment the board and lodging rate for the board and lodging portion of their care, so that at least we would know that people are not as likely to not show up for treatment the next day?
Mr.
Chair and Senator Berglund, I think that's where we originated from in the 2008 change in the rules, was to attempt to provide more support. This board and lodge care would not be paid for. If we paid those providers, we would not have this savings.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my understanding, and I must say that this has been a very confusing conversation, but my understanding was that you are paying for board and lodge costs for people in the Medicaid program and in the Minnesota Care program. So then my question is, why don't you just reduce your payment to the residential providers to the level that they would otherwise be paid for board and lodging, rather than having people in a board and lodging facility and then in a separate treatment facility?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I too have found this conversation to be confusing. And I would recommend that perhaps we do a memo to you on this budget page and on the board and lodging, and try to answer some of the questions that have been posed. Or we could come back at another time, too.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that brings me back to my question, that if we're sending 1,900 into outpatient, have we done anything different? Is there any reform in our treatment protocol to make sure that there is a success in our outpatient, or are we just setting these folks up for failure? Because obviously there is a reason why we have residential. It's more intensive. And that's what I'm asking, is it a longer duration? What are the differences? Can we backfill or stopgap the differences in the outpatient to make sure that there is a success story at the end, or are we going to have the high recidivism rate again? So I'm looking for some reform here. I'm looking for some reform. That's what I want to hear, is what we're doing to make these treatment programs work.
Well,
thank you.
Mr. Senator Chairman Burton. And Senator Rosen, I agree with you, but even if you have a more effective intensive outpatient program, it isn't going to work if somebody isn't showing up.
Well, members Ms. O'Connell and Mr. Anderson and Mr. Weiss, I think we'll have to invite you to come back tomorrow. We did not quite get through this whole section of the budget changes, and we have not gotten to the sex offender program or the continuing care. We are running a little bit behind. I appreciate your patience, but if you'd be willing to come back tomorrow, we can continue our presentation. And members, thank you for your participation, and we are adjourned.